Thank you very much. If I begin to cough, it's not an insult to the Democratic Party. I think that to those of you who have not lived through the period when the dictatorship, both of Europe and in a way of Latin America, came to the fore, the term dictatorship must be really coupled with the idea of a man. I think that one talks about the dictatorship of Nazism and immediately this evokes the picture of Hitler, a one-man operation. The same would go for the fascists in Italy. And to some extent, although the picture is somewhat different, for some people, the whole concept of communism is associated with Stalin, perhaps because of the modern, or of those who succeeded Lenin, the founder of the Soviet Union. He is the one who stayed in power the longest. And in Latin America, of course, we associate the whole movement in Argentina, which was called Peronista, with Perón. And while I think that there is, of course, one basic truth in all of this, namely that one man really spearheaded the movement, brought it to a head and gave it his own impetus, the fact remains that dictatorships do not necessarily have to have one man at the head. A person who stands at the front of the stage, so to speak, is very recognizable and makes it easy for those who disapprove of the dictatorship to hit him and use him as a target. There are other forms of dictatorship. In fact, I would be inclined to say that with the experience that there has been through the middle of the 20th century with one-man dictatorships, in the sense that these were started by one man, they're not likely to occur again, because people become very wary of any one man trying to reach power, so long as the example of what happened with Hitler, Mussolini, and Perón, and Franco in Spain, is still before us. I am not including in this a mention of Stalin, because I think Stalin is just the perfect indication of the fact that dictatorship, certainly in the Soviet Union, is not a one-man affair. I think that we have to, if we are going to protect ourselves from the dangers of dictatorship, I think we have to revise our definition of what a dictatorship is. Because while the dictatorship of one man is no longer, as I said before, quite as possible a peril to us, the dictatorship in a broader sense of an idea or of a group is very possible. And therefore, I think unless one redefines what is meant by dictatorship, one might fall prey to the dictatorship of an idea or of a group, particularly in this country. The dictatorship, while, as I say, perhaps the dictionary attaches the term to one man, is really the dominance of one concept or one idea over a mass of people. An idea which is then translated into a program and therefore penetrates into the life of the people and enlaces them in, draws them in as in a net. No dictatorship can ever arise, whether it is spearheaded by one man who then remains the titular head of it, or whether it is the dictatorship of an idea and is implemented by a group of people, no matter which, it cannot come to the top unless the conditions of society are favorable to it. When I first came to this country in 1937, people couldn't understand why such a large number of the most cultivated Italians had accepted fascism. They couldn't understand why the top class in Germany had accepted Nazism. And they began to talk back about, oh, look at all the great struggle that Italy went through, pointing the way to the rest of the world and the freedom of ideas and patterns of democracy, the ancient republic, not only of Rome, but of all the great states, the city states, the great republic of Venice, of Florence, etc. How could they? And then they spoke of Germany in similar terms, and many of the concepts of freedom and great intellectual development that had happened there. Well, the point is that when these men came up and disseminated these particular ideas, which then gave the name to a whole system, fascism and Nazism, certain circumstances in the masses of the people were ripe for that sort of thing. And I think this is where we have to beware. I feel that the study of history, whether it is ancient or relatively recent history, is extremely interesting as an intellectual exercise. It happens to be one of the fields that I favor most and have worked in. But I think that when one is taking particularly these examples of fairly recent history, the most necessary thing to do is relate oneself to them to see whether such a pattern could occur again. Therefore, if we are trying to analyze how dictatorships start and why, it is vital, unless you want to involve yourselves in a strictly intellectual exercise, to see how such a thing could happen right here. I say that just as when you plant a seed, you have to have the right soil, the right climate, the proper conditions for that seed to produce the plant, the blossom, and the fruit at its best. You can have a stunted growth, but to produce the fullness of its fruit, you have to have the right soil, the right climate, the right nourishment. So for the idea, for any idea, you have to have this kind of environment. However, just as you can create artificially the proper environment for a seed or a plant, that is, you supplement what the soil lacks with fertilizers, you cover a plant against too cold a winter, you shade a plant from too strong a sunshine, so can you create the necessary environment for a plant? You can do this for an idea. And where I see a danger, right here in this country, particularly if the war in Vietnam should prolong itself, should we be obliged, because of the weight of world opinion, to yield more than our own pride would like to have us yield? If in years to come the tremendous growth which China inevitably will take on should become even more of a threat to us than it is today, if all of these things were to make us face challenges which we have not prepared ourselves for, then I think that the danger that in order to accept these challenges we might accept a dictatorship is not an impossibility. We have, I think, allowed ourselves to accept the thinking of other people and other forces, so that from a country whose great strength has always been its diversity, not only diversity in the sense of the people and the strains and the traditions and the cultures and the races that have formed this country, but also a diversity of ideas coming from a diversity of backgrounds and of interests and concerns. This has always been a great strength. This diversity, not only in the years that I've been here, but I would say at an increasing pace in the last 15 or 20 years, has yielded to tremendous conformity. Dictators have tried to create conformity where they didn't find it in order to be able to establish their rule with little problems. Not merely conformity of manners, methods, a way of life. This is not important. It's conformity of thought. And I think that we suffer a great deal from conformity of thought, particularly among the younger generation, I would say, not so much in the few, relatively speaking, as related to the thousands and thousands who are in colleges. There are always a few who decide, I am going to undertake this rather unusual career. I am going to undertake this rather unusual field of research. You always find these, but these are exceptions. You have a great amorphous mass, which is in college to get a piece of paper, thanks to which you can get a job, and thanks to which job you can earn a living, and just carry on. For what particular purpose, nobody knows. The movies that are successful are all the same in all the cities of the United States. The books that hit the bestseller market in all of the reading areas, particularly the cities of the United States, are always the same. When you look around, you find that tastes are extraordinarily conforming. People don't have the courage to stand up and say, well, I am not going to wear a skirt that comes around the middle of my thigh. It's the fashion, and you see a whole lot of young and not so young ladies pulling their skirts up above their knees when it happens that whoever made human knees really didn't put an excess of beauty in that joint, probably because it was not supposed to be seen. But whatever it is, it is not the most beautiful part of anybody's anatomy. But nobody has the courage to say no. And I'm not accusing us of being alone in this, because there are other countries that are doing it, but I'm not concerned with what they're doing. Let us look at ourselves. In these lesser manifestations, I think we show this tendency. And therefore, when you begin to get somebody who gets up, has power of expression, has a certain appeal, and who touches certain of the chords that we know are responsive in people, because there is a conformity of response, first of all, inherent in all people, and secondly, it can be fashioned and shaped as we allow ourselves to be fashioned and shaped by advertising particularly, this person can sweep a multitude. I know, because I lived there, that Mussolini had to work very hard in an era in which you had very limited mass media of communication. There was only radio in those days, there was no television, and you didn't have, well, it's hard to believe this, but not only was there no television in the 20s, but in the early 30s, but there was no aviation that carried people across oceans. Consequently, means of travel were less speedy, means of communication between people were not mass means of communication. So he had very little to do with, and yet he had to work very hard to mold the Italian people into a fairly common shape, so that when he imposed his ideas, they would all evoke the same responses in all people. He found, of course, as Hitler did in Germany, as Stalin or Lenin rather had found in Russia, a substratum of conditions that were conducive to change. No dictatorship ever comes to power unless it is advocating change. And the basic condition necessary to make it successful is that people should want change. And people, the masses of the people, the majority of the people, whether it is the majority of 200 million people or the majority of 40 million people, it will always be a majority within that society, are wanting change for the best. Here, I don't know that it would be possible for any of the white segment of our population to be demanding a change for the better in a material sense. We are at the peak of affluence, on the whole. But you find instead that the colored section of our population is reaching a point that can even become dangerously riotous, because they are demanding change from appalling conditions of life to even moderately better conditions of life. They are accepting what I would describe as the dictatorship of a man like Stokely Carmichael. Among them, they have had the potential leadership of an extraordinary person, Dr. Martin Luther King, whom I have the privilege of knowing. This is anything except the dictatorship that he would have in mind. But what has happened? The condition in which the masses of the Negro people in America have been living, particularly those areas in which they are closely jammed together, the Watts, the Harlems, and other such places. A man who speaks like Martin Luther King does not find conditions favorable. He is not speaking to people or for people, or he cannot evoke the response of people who are straining at the bit, who are living in absolutely subhuman conditions. He can be appealing to people of his own race, or to people of the white race, who think as he does, or highly educated people, or to those who are calm and long-suffering and are willing to undertake change without violence. But the masses of his own people are living in absolutely terrible conditions, particularly those, as I say, in these great human agglomerations. And therefore comes a person who tries to induce riot and violence and so forth. They listen to him because they have been conformed by the same conditions of poverty. And these are conditions which they have been told are unfair conditions. They must rise out of them. Consequently, comes a person who incites them to violence. He becomes their dictator. And they set aside the one who could have been their leader. And here we come to a definition which is very rarely made. And I think we have here two very good examples right in our own time and in the middle of our own country. A man like Carmichael and a man like Martin Luther King. They are both of the same race. They both see the problem. They both have experience going to school and coming up and being raised largely among white people. They know what they're after. But look at the difference. Martin Luther King is a man who seeks to persuade. Maybe some of his arguments can be powerful, couched in very profound, even shaking reality, and I have heard him made this, but this is a man who preaches non-violence and seeks to have people follow him. This is a leader. The other one is a man who really wants to achieve for his own people. Same condition, but what does he do? He appeals to the worst instinct. Because those instincts have been irritated, have been agitated by conditions. And they will do anything for the change. And when a mass of people have decided they want a change, A, they always want it in a hurry. No revolution has ever waited. It is no social revolution, ever. And secondly, they don't care what means they use to achieve it. When you think of what the McCarthy era, which was a patent, flagrant example of a dictatorship in a certain area which became accepted right in this country, this man had a dictatorship over the Senate. Nobody dared speak. Years after his disappearance, people who kept their mouths shut because they were afraid have had the courage now, the delayed courage, to get up and say, I knew he was lying, but I didn't dare say anything because I would have lost my job. This man exercised a dictatorship which could have led to violence, and it did in a sort of way lead to violence because it deprived some people of their job, of gathering the fruits of their entire career. He rode roughshod over everybody, over every principle, over everything that we ever heard of. He launched charges and accusations of which he was never able to substantiate any. And yet this man dominated everything. dominated our headlines, dominated people's lives. What it did to the television, to the radio industry, unless you were in it, as I was, you couldn't believe possible. It was enough to mention the name. You know, McCarthy said to somebody the other day that so-and-so is probably a communist. The network would drop a person like that without ever consulting any of the parties involved in such a statement. This is a dictatorship. You don't have to have a bunch of goose-stepping, marching people in a black uniform to have a dictatorship. In my opinion, Mr. Rockwell with his Nazis right there across the bridge from us in Washington is a shocking sight that anybody in this country would ever want to wear on their armband, a swastika, and parade with posters as I have seen, say, rid this country of all the Jews and all the niggers, I'm quoting. This is shocking, this is revolting, that there could, anybody could have been raised in this country who could think this way. But to my mind, that's less dangerous because they parade in the streets. And the effect they have on me, I'm sure, is the effect they have on almost everybody else, certainly on everybody I know they have the same effect, so they lose their danger. If you see a red light that says don't cross, you know that there must be danger and you don't cross. They are in themselves a red light. But the danger comes where you have an open trench and there's no sign to show that you could kill yourself. And this is the McCarthy type of dictatorship. This is the man who, sure he went on television, but this is the man who used the conditions he found. What were the conditions? The United States coming out of the Second World War with the Soviet Union as an ally knew extremely well that if the Soviet Union had not been able to resist until we were ready to come into the war, Hitler would have won. He would have retained his supremacy. It was because they were able, with the siege at Stalingrad and in other places, to resist long enough for us to come in. We sent them aid, we sent them weapons, we sent them everything to do with so that they could hold their front until we got ready. We knew this. We thought that when the war was over, they would continue to not challenge us, to not oppose us, to not start the war of ideology. And we were absolutely overcome, unprepared and frightened to death, because we didn't know how to handle them. Because we had already gone through a period in which anybody who suggested studying Marxism was instantly frowned upon because he might have been a communist. Consequently, we faced a suddenly powerful, arrogant communism without knowing how to handle it. Not that we hadn't had every opportunity, but we hadn't prepared ourselves. Consequently, we were terribly afraid. And the fear, because we had a latent knowledge that we didn't know how to oppose them, therefore this gave us a fear, whether acknowledged or subconscious or whatever it was, that we might be defeated after a victory in the war. They might still conquer the whole world. And so anybody who came along comforted us by pointing an accusing finger at us. It made us feel good. Oh yes, McCarthy, you see, he ferrets them out. He's wonderful. There were the favorable conditions. And since we tended to conform, it was not the fashion to study communism, so nobody did, and nobody knew what to do about it. So here comes this man who makes use of the common fear that was the condition, who exploits the ignorance of people, because half the things he said, not only about individuals, and his charges were completely untrue, but what he said about communism itself was false. He never succeeded in putting his finger on what was the real evil of communism, because he didn't know enough himself. But people fell for all this, and we accepted the intellectual dictatorship of McCarthyism. Now, very few people would call this a dictatorship, because in our own minds we've associated the term with something that goose-steps, that is led by a man in power, therefore at the head of the government, and McCarthy was never, thank goodness, in power in that sense. He didn't need goose-stepping people. But his dictatorship has left as much of an impression on the American mind as a whole, has left a dent in it, as Nazism and fascism, even though both of them are also defeated, has left in the minds of the Germans and of the Italians. Now, why did he accept it? He accepted it, I think, because it's General Eisenhower, later himself, by that paragon of Americanism known as Goldwater, Eisenhower was called a communist, a conscious communist. Mr. Eisenhower was the man who, being a military man, knew very well that if you're ever going to defeat your enemy, the first thing you study about your enemy is his strength and not his weakness. When you know the full measure of his strength and respect it, as any military man does of his enemies, then you begin to see where the weak spots are. But you don't satisfy yourself with the obvious weaknesses, lest upon attacking those, you bring upon yourself an avalanche of the unsuspected strength. And he, when he became president of Columbia University, instituted what has become today one of the world's greatest centers for the study of communism and therefore the understanding of it at Columbia University. I happen to have been teaching there at that time. And believe me, you, his friends, his Republican friends, his conservative friends, were very eager to have him run for the presidency, and therefore they did not accuse him of being a communist, because they would have killed their own candidate even before they presented him. But this was one of the few reasons for which he then was able to institute this course, using his prestige and the fact that he was wanted as a candidate. He was horrified that while he had been out there in the battlefield, this ideological enemy called communism had really come full-fledged on the stage, and he came back home here and nobody knew anything about it. We were going about fighting it in a way that was so childish that has won very convinced communist who later turned against it, a Russian whom I knew very well in Paris, said to me once, you know, really, my fellow countrymen, if they were really honest, they would give the medal of Lenin to your country, because by your incomprehension of communism, you've done more to help it expand than it could ever have done itself. And this is a fact. We, particularly you in the younger generation, have to realize that in this country, the greatest danger of all could be that if we were faced with a challenge without the habit of it, because about two generations have passed that haven't any habit of a challenge, we've never known what it means to fight a war except for the people we kill, but we kill more people on the highways than we kill in wars. But we can't have any real attachment to life, that's obvious. Consequently, we've never seen, and I hope we never do, the entire town in which you live bombed out of recognition. The people you loved and cared for buried under the ruins. This is something that matures people. We have not had this experience. And I say that there is enough in this country of everything, not only of the material things, but even of the gifts of the mind and of the heart and of courage, to enable us to achieve this maturity, whereby we will not be prey to something that could someday be regarded as another dictatorship, perhaps not a la McCarthy. You know, one of the great dangers in which we may fall is precisely the dictatorship of the concept of my rights. You hear people all the time who say, well, I have a right to this. I have a right to that. You rarely hear them say, I have a duty. I have a responsibility. This, the dictatorship of I have rights, is something that can lead any government we have. And I don't care what party it is, because it's not a matter of party. This is a matter of people. Can lead any government to so make prisoners the American people under the guise of granting them their rights. You have a right to housing, so I give it to you. You have a right to a job, so I give it to you, even if you're not equipped for it. You have a right to medicine, even if you're not sick, here it is. You have a right to everything. And we have so told ourselves that we have a right, you have a right, you have a right. You never hear a child say you have a duty.